Welcome to Insight on the Progressive Radio Network. My name is Mark Farrow. How are you feeling on Thursday morning? Broadcasting live from Midtown Manhattan. Glorious day. We got a packed show. And from Manhattan, we're going right to Cape May, right away, New Jersey. Part of the Unity Police Ride. It's a multiple-day ride. Hundreds of miles with thousands of police officers. That was created back in 1997 by a New Jersey police officer to respect all the men that have been falling in the line of duty. Mark Waddell, how are you feeling?
How are you, Mark Farrell?
How's it going out there, my friend? How are your legs? How's your body? How's your mind?
The body is breaking down, but the mind is sharp.
How many miles have you logged?
It was 90 yesterday as a group, and we're about 30 in today right now, probably a total of 60.
You're at the most southern point of New Jersey, and now what's next? The ferry ride to Delaware?
Well, we're on our way right now. We're in Dennis Township. We're probably about 17 miles from the Cape May Lewis Ferry, and then we'll be in Lewis, Delaware overnight tonight before we head over to Annapolis for day three ride.
Now, as I mentioned, this is something obviously significantly started in 1997, and it's grown immeasurably, raised millions and millions of dollars for a museum, and more importantly, for families that have lost their fathers or mothers due to losing their lives in a line of duty. What does this mean for you, and how important is it for you to be part of this?
Oh, I mean, just the day four when we're riding into Washington, D.C., and you see the crowds, and then especially the night after the candlelight vigil when you see the families, it really breaks your heart and really motivates you to do it the following year and raise the money to help the families of the fallen, because it's just a tremendous thing that these families are going through. And if we can help in any way, that's what we're here for.
Is it sort of a double-edged sword because it reaffirms what you do for a living, but also at the same time you say to yourself, wow, I'm a father, I'm a husband, and I'm in a dangerous line of work?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, most times we take it for granted. This is just our job. It's like being a banker or a lawyer or whatever. It's just something that we do. And you forget sometimes, and this is definitely a reality check of something bad can happen at any time.
Just like being on a bicycle.
Yeah, this is quite a feat.
Talk about the camaraderie. I mean, it must be palpable when you're with thousands of people, like-minded, doing something for the same cause. And I'm sure you're surrounded with people who have lost fellow officers in the line of duty as well.
Oh, yeah. Tremendous story. My first time doing it, I was lucky enough to do the honor guard the night of the vigil. And I walked a family down. It was a mother and a father. And they told me about their son got shot and killed. I think he was in the state of Montana. No, definitely in the Northwest. And it must have been 20 minutes later, I grab another a younger couple, and I'm talking to them. And ironically, it was the daughter of the parents I just walked down, and it was her brother that was killed in line of duty.
Wow.
Just, I'll never forget that. And we stayed in touch. I sent them a letter and two, and they've sent letters back. And if I ever find myself in the state of Montana or Wyoming, I forget where they're from right now, but I'm sure I can get a nice dinner.
To say the least, I imagine, right? Now, when you think of the word Unity Tour, especially in the confines of the landscape of geopolitical and political landscape on a national basis here, we think about the police coming together with community, which certainly is, I imagine, a byproduct of this because you're going in to all these communities and showing symbolically how powerful, but how normal and how everyday people are, officers in blue, out of blue, on the bikes, riding to save lives.
Let me tell you, when I rode into this last stop, and we're actually getting on our bikes right now to get down to KMA, but the gentleman I was talking to been on the job 37 years in Alameda County, California, and they took it upon themselves, obviously, to come all the way out here, but to ship their bikes and ship their motorcycles to be part of this. So, yeah, it is tremendous. You see the amount of people that come from so far away and what an expense of their time and monetarily just to pay for everything. It's tremendous.
Quite a feat. And we're going to let you go. But finally, just tell us about the culmination in Washington, D.C.
Well, as far as when we get down there Saturday afternoon, There's a quick little ceremony, and then the following night is the candlelight vigil. And if you ever just YouTube candlelight vigil, the memorial, you'll get a good visual of what we what we're doing that night. It's just really cool.
Mark Waddell, all the best to you. Thank you for your very short of time ride here, and I appreciate that. And the miles, countless miles that you're logging with all the thousands of fellow officers. May the wind be at your back, and always have safety in mind, my friend. All the best to you.
Thanks. Take care, buddy.
All the best to you. My name is Mark Farrell. The show is In Sight. In a few minutes, you're going to meet Layla Love. She is a supremely talented artist who has personally emancipated women in conflict zones from prostitution, slavery, and other forms of human trafficking. We're going to meet Layla. She has an exhibit opening in a week, actually, Thursday, May 17th, right here in New York City, entitled Rise. But before we get to Layla, I want to talk to you about a new book, The Class of 74, Congress After Watergate and the Roots of Partisanship. Yeah, there's a lot packed in there, right? Joining me from I don't actually know where is author John Lawrence. John is a visiting professor at the University of California's Washington Center and worked in the House of Representatives. For this alone, he should get a medal. For 38 years, the last eight as chief of staff to Nancy Pelosi. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Mark. It's good to be with you.
Thank you. I don't know where to start, but, you know, we're in constant battles between left and right, legislative gridlock, government shutdown, all seemingly routine. No wonder why they have the worst rating in history, Congress. I mean, where do we go from here, and how did we get here?
It's a long story, and that's really part of what I talk about in this book. The key, I think, is to understand that the problems we're facing today, the ones you talk about, the hyper-partisanship, the gridlock, the inability of Congress to respond to issues that even the country agrees need to be addressed, like immigration or gun policy, these are the origins here go back decades, and they have to do with changing demographics in the country, this revival of a Republican Party that had a very strong evangelical conservative base to it, parity between the parties, which means the parties are fighting over control much more than they did earlier in the 20th century.
Yeah, the gloves are off for sure.
Yeah, cultural divides, very ideologically based media, the rise of independent money that promotes more extreme candidates. All these things really roll together into a toxic brew that is very now deeply embedded in our politics.
Now, you're right. Don't blame Trump, Obama, Bush, or Clinton. Instead, you credit the outrage generated by President Gerald Ford's unanticipated pardon of Richard Nixon. Explain that, please.
Well, the pardon of Nixon clearly played a key role in the decision of voters to send this class of 74 to Washington in 1974 in that key election. And that wasn't the only issue. There was a bad economy. Mm. There was Watergate. There was the energy crisis. But clearly what people wanted was a change in politics. And it's not unlike what we see now. They had lost confidence in government. They had lost faith that the Congress was being responsive to issues. And they had lost confidence that the entire political system was legitimate. So I think we see a lot of parallels to the kinds of concerns that we see today. And what happened was this large group of new people came in, 76 new Democrats, 49-seat pickup of Republican seats, and they joined with a smaller group of reformers who had been there to really democratize with a small d this institution so that it was freed from some of the real autocratic control by a small number of people. Power was disseminated. More young people, more liberal people in many cases were given opportunities to serve and chair on subcommittees. And that led issues, whether it be environment or women's rights or consumer protection or energy, really start bubbling up rather than being held down and by a very top-heavy, conservative, autocratic, chairman-based system.
And was the icing on the cake the actual timing of the pardon?
it certainly didn't help the Republican candidates in the fall of 1974. In fact, a group of them went down. A group of Republicans went down to see President Ford in just before the pardon occurred. The pardon occurred in September, only 2 months before the election.
Wow!
And they said, "Boy, don't do that. That's really going to hurt us in the fall." And he said, "Well, you know, if I don't do this pardon, I'm afraid this issue of Nixon's potential guilt and potential criminal prosecution could linger all the way to 1976 and could be really harmful for me when I'm running for president." And their response was, "Well, yeah, that's interesting. That's 2 years from now. Our election is 2 months from now, so don't do it." Hmm. He went ahead and did it anyway, and I think a lot of people believe that was the last straw as far as Watergate and as far as losing confidence in the presidency.
John Lawrence, is there a parallel here with what you just mentioned and also the midterms coming up? With the Democrats thinking they can actually do quite well because of all the peril happening right now?
I do think there are some interesting parallels. There is, as there was in 1974, there are a lot of first-time candidates. There are a lot of candidates who have not run for office before who come out of very diverse backgrounds. In 1974, you had ministers and educators. You even had a house painter running. This time, we see a lot of veterans running. We see people who have worked in community organizations. We see people from the religious community as well. I think that that serves a really important function for voters to see that there's new blood coming into the Congress. There are people who are prepared to break with old traditions and challenge the institution. The key is going to be whether or not there is the same motivation to come out and vote that people felt in 1974 because of Watergate and because of the recession and because of the pardon and other issues. One of the real problems we have, Mark, is that our voter turnout in this country is not good, and it's particularly not good in midterm elections like 2018 will be. And the less voter turnout you get, the more likely it is that people on the extreme will influence the outcome of the election. You end up with a more polarized Congress and a less productive Congress. So we've got to really find ways of motivating that middle group of voters who understandably are pretty discouraged to come out and vote.
Why are they not motivated? They feel it's fruitless for midterms?
I think that our politics is very presidential focused. So it's difficult for people to focus on the Congress as a whole because there's so many moving pieces and there's so many players. And also the party organizations, particularly at the national level, have tended to do a better job turning people out for presidential elections than they have for midterm elections. You know, to be honest about it, our turnout is not that good in presidential years. 60 or 62% tends to be a pretty good turnout. That means almost a third of the electorate is not choosing to vote even in a presidential year.
What was the number with Obama, his first election?
Yeah, the numbers were up a little bit for Obama into the mid 60s, but you know that was a very was a very unique turnout, but we were still way below what we see in many other Western democracies.
Interesting. Now, do you think this is actually, before I go there, your 38 years of experience, there's got to be something obviously that pulls you and draws you to these moving parts that you eloquently so put it in Congress. What do you love the most about Congress and what do you have disdain for?
What the wonderful thing about working in Congress, when it's working, when it's operative, is that you can really address issues that dramatically impact people's lives. The first big piece of legislation that I worked on, for example, when I went to Congress in 1975, was the Education for Handicapped Children Act.
Wow.
This is an issue where we found that children were literally being kept in warehouses and locked in institutions and were not being given educational rights. Many of the people who had worked in the civil rights movement had moved over into education and children's policy, and the guy I was working for, a young 29-year-old legislator from California, very concerned about disability rights from his work in the state legislature in California, we went to work on that. We created a system where every disabled child has a right to specialized education and a whole series of legal means of protecting that. We moved on and wrote legislation for adoptive children and for foster care children to give them the same rights. And that was just in the first few years. You have this ability in Congress to find issues where by writing legislation carefully, going through the process of hearings and deliberations, which we don't see very much now, of identifying problems that are out there affecting millions of people and writing laws that literally change lives. And if you can do that, it's an enormously gratifying place to work.
I can't imagine. Sure.
Mark, I want to add that most of what I did over those 38 years, even though I worked for pretty partisan people, I mean, I worked for, you know, the Speaker of the House, and she was obviously a pretty partisan, but most of the legislation I wrote, we worked on a bipartisan basis. That's one of the challenges today. The place is a lot more partisan. It's a lot harder to get people to work across the aisles. But certainly my experience was bipartisan. And in fact, when I retired, Speaker Pelosi and Speaker Boehner both together gave me an award because of my work on behalf of the House.
Well, talk about rewarding. Wow, that must have just sealed the deal for you.
Yeah, it felt pretty good.
Well, now talk about, it's interesting, I wasn't even going to go there this morning, but you bring up an interesting fact about how legislators, you know, have bipartisan ways to come together and illustrate and create law. Is it becoming increasingly difficult for that to happen? And if it is it more one-sided? And the simple thing is, are they writing laws as clearly and, I can't say concisely, as all-encompassing as it should be?
Yeah, the answer is no. I mean, I think really over the last several years, and it's unfortunate for the American people, I think we've just seen Congress struggling to simply pass the most basic laws to keep the lights on and the place functioning, you know, these continuing appropriations, these essential, what we call in Congress, must-pass laws. But there's been a real inability, with the exception of the tax bill, that's a separate issue, which I'm happy to talk about, to deal with problems that even the American people know are serious problems that need to be dealt with. Immigration is the most obvious. It's been banging around in Congress really for a decade and more, and there is bipartisan support in the country. There's more than 80% of the country, for example, thinks we should pass a DACA bill to address these children who are here through no fault of their own. There's even an effort now being made in the House of Representatives by a bipartisan group, including Republican members, defying their own leadership, who won't bring a bill up, saying we're going to use a parliamentary technique to bring it up. So it's very difficult to get these policy issues out there. My argument, though, is this is an issue of who's in charge. It's not a question of the institution. Now, I can take you back only 10 years when 10 years ago when I worked very closely with John Boehner. I worked with George Bush and with Secretary of Treasury Hank Paulson. And we really prevented the collapse of the economy during the financial crisis of 2008. And that was done on a bipartisan basis a few weeks before a very partisan election, a presidential and congressional election. And the institution hasn't changed at all. The rules haven't changed at all. It's really just a question of whether or not the folks who are running the place have the ability and the will to make it function as
it has. It seems like there was a little give and take and a lot of flexibility, but overall, things have not changed. My guest today is John Lawrence. He's the author of The Class of 74, Congress After Watergate and the Roots of Partisanship. So on the heels of what you just said, John, about who's in charge here, how long do you think it's going to fix everything that Trump is unraveling? Talk about a heavy question.
Yeah, well, I mean, the part of the problems here is that the president is using all executive authority to do most of what he is doing. You know, President Obama ended up using executive orders on a whole series of issues, including something like DACA. He did it after several years where the Congress, which is controlled by the opposite party, simply would not legislate. Mm-hmm. And I think his position ended up being, look, I got elected to do something here, other
exactly.
than just sit around and watch something.
It was warranted.
Sunrise. But when President Trump came in, his party controls the Congress, but he hasn't been able or hasn't sought to use the laws. He's instead relied on these executive orders to simply weaken the Affordable Care Act or change DACA or rescind trade agreements. So to some extent, a different president, a different Congress could move these policies in different directions. They could move them back. That's not an ideal way of making law. You know, either foreign countries or businesses or the average citizen wants there to be some continuity and some planning involved, and they want to be able to rely on the United States. I think this latest decision of the president canceling the Iran nuclear agreement is a good example. How do foreign governments, let alone North Korea, that we're going to start negotiating with, how do they rely on the word of the United States if you one person comes into office and undoes years of work on a nuclear agreement or undoes the trade agreement that was negotiated on a multilateral basis? I think that's a really bad way to make laws. We've got to go back to a system, and it's a messy system. Democracy is a little bit messy. Working through Congress is messier than just having one person make a declaration. But that's how you flesh these policies out and you write them in a comprehensive way, and how you build public understanding and public support, and that's how they endure. This idea of just coming into office and waving magic wand saying, this is the way I want it because that's what I said in a campaign, it's very disruptive, and it's not good policy because obviously the next person comes in and does the exact same thing, and you just lurch from policy to policy.
It's not a dictatorship.
It is not. No, it is
so
not.
So, John, on the heels of that, you know, you've been doing this for 38 years, obviously retired for a few years, held vital, vital positions. And I'm really happy, by the way, to have you on the show with that experience. I'm shaking my next guest's hand, pardon me. With the advent, obviously, of technology, it's on the forefront of politics, obviously, with possibly a whole election being swayed, et cetera. Influencers, how do you think this is going to influence, be a vital part of politics in a good way and bad way moving forward?
Well, you know, the changes in technology have really been significant. Daniel Moynihan, who was a senator from New York, used to say, you're entitled to your own facts, your own opinion, but you're not entitled to your own facts. And unfortunately today, because of the way in which both the large media, cable TV particularly, but also social media works, people really just listen to very often to what they want to listen to, and they don't consider other people's opinions. They don't even get presented contrary points of view. In the past, we had something called the Fairness Doctrine. President Reagan got rid of that in 1987, and that said that if you had a broadcast license, you had to balance what you were sending out on the airwaves so that people could decide for themselves. That was gotten rid of. The technology came in that allowed you to bypass any kind of credibility or factual filter, and I think that's a genie that's pretty hard to put back in the bottle. One of the ways we can do it, I think, is maybe restoring something like the Fairness Doctrine, but the other way is by really improving the civic education that we have in our schools. It's almost an afterthought in most public education, and it really means that voters don't know how the government works, don't know what to expect of it, don't know what to demand of it, and how to turn those demands into political power. And we really need to have people engaged and educated. Just engaged without being educated isn't enough.
Absolutely. And with that said, now that you're a private citizen, John,
yeah,
I'm sure you're probably a little bit relieved to be on the outside of Washington, the Beltway, for a while, and obviously doing some great work and imparting some great information on these students' minds as a professor. What do you say to listeners who get so disenchanted? For example, like yesterday, where does he go? Is it actually in Korea? Or where was the actual release of the three hostages? Wherever it was. But he's acting like this is something he's worked on for years. He's taking sole credit, et cetera. And it's just something that's just kind of disenchanting. But how is it from someone who's been so close involved politically to speaking to the average everyday citizen who wants to do something and frustrated? But of course, we have to shake off the frustration. What can we do, and why shouldn't we give up?
You know, that's a great question, and it's a perfectly understandable one. There's an old expression in politics, you can't fight City Hall. And I have a friend who used to say, well, that was probably made up by somebody in City Hall. They didn't want to be bothered by anybody. You know, people, I find, underestimate how influential they can be. And I actually wrote a column on this that appeared in the LA Times last year, where I sort of talked about how people can influence members of Congress. I really encourage them to go to town hall meetings, to ask for meetings with members of Congress when they're back in their district, and present them with issues, put together coalitions. You know, if you're concerned about health care, put together a doctor and an advocacy organization and a nurses group and a hospital group and an insurer, and go in and tell these members what they want. Or if you have a local environmental or an education problem, you'd be amazed how accessible you are. But there's no substitute for voting. There's no substitute for registering to vote. And I certainly understand, and I totally can appreciate how people look and say, well, nothing ever changes. But you know, things do change.
They do.
We did get 30 million people mm-hmm. health care who never had health care before, and that was a pretty proud moment. And I stood on the House floor with very hard-bitten members of Congress with tears running down their face because they had done something that had been attempted for 100 years to do.
So, not perfect, but that's okay. It's a start.
Right. Well, you know, that's true of every law. You
exactly.
know, you never pass big
mm-hmm.
laws that you don't go back
and sometimes of marriages, too.
Yes. You know, so look, lawmaking is an organic process. You do it the best you can. You go back and you fix it. I mean, one of the real problems with the Affordable Care Act is that instead of trying to fix it, we've had a group of people who've just been trying to repeal it with nothing to replace it with. And so that's not good policymaking. But going back and holding it accountable and saying, where is it working? Where does it need fixing? That's perfectly legitimate, those questions to ask. And I will just say this. You mentioned my students. One of the most gratifying things I found is that since the election of 2016, which I have to say, my students, they're all California students, many of them are first-generation Americans, they were pretty discouraged, to put it mildly. But virtually every student I've had in class since then has said that the outcome of the election has made them more determined to get involved in politics. And that's generally what I've heard from friends around the country who are teaching, that young people are engaged. We know that women are engaged. That's terrific news. And if they really do turn out and vote and then stick with the system, some are going to win, some are going to lose, but stick with it. You know, just like I found when I went to work in Washington all those years ago, if you go to work and you make demands of the system and you don't give up, you're going to be surprised at how much you can accomplish.
Absolutely. And then very quickly, we're going to have to leave right here. But
yep.
Think about what we did accomplish in the last 8-10 years. We put an African-American in office, a very qualified candidate. We almost had a woman, first female president. Great strides have been made. Yes, it feels like we've taken one step forward, two steps back. I think it's temporary. But nonetheless, progress is being made. We have to keep our voices being heard. More importantly, actions. We need to stay involved. Get involved on a grassroots level. See what your skill set is. Maybe you're cut out for politics. And yes, there's give and take in politics. It's not always just I want, and this is what I can get. Just like anything, you go to buy a car. You know, you want to you negotiate, and you have to give a little. You can't
absolutely.
Get the leather seats every time if you want a cheaper price.
That's absolutely correct. That's exactly the mindset that people have to have. Just like in this class of 74, there was a young minister in eastern Pennsylvania. He just got fed up with the war in Vietnam. He got fed up with Watergate. He literally looked up in the yellow pages. Democratic Party went in, took out papers, and 6 months later he was a member of Congress. So it can happen, and people should be motivated, and they will see those kinds of results.
The class of 74, Congress After Watergate and the Roots of Partisanship, available by Johns Hopkins University Press. My guest is John A. Lawrence. Thank you so much for a fine piece and for your time, John.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
All the best to you, my friend.
You too. Take care now.
My name is Mark Farrell. The show is Insight. Thanks for joining me this and every Thursday. It is my pleasure to introduce my next guest, Layla Love. Layla Love's art aims to illustrate or illuminate our human consciousness. That's a huge task. She captures life as a series of adventures and expeditions into the unknown, returning always with a greater sense of what it means to be human. So for our Facebook viewers and listeners, you're about to see a piece that kind of illustrates what her work is about.
There's still a misconception that sex trafficking only happens in developing nations. But the truth is, every day children are being trafficked in our cities, being exploited for profit. When we bring everything into the light, the darkness no longer has power. We are at a turning point where we desperately need others to awaken, to offer their voices, to bring an end to this injustice. there is hope on the other side worth fighting for.
Layla Love, welcome to the show. You have a huge heart, my dear.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure for us to be here.
And an eye that is unlike any others, and an eye that's obviously been trained since probably your darkest times, starting at age 5, but trained to see pictures not solely as just pictures, because from what I've read, sometimes you think pictures are just lies because they're not telling the whole truth. Is that correct?
Well, I think life is complicated and has many layers, and therein nothing isolated can tell a whole truth. Mm. And so I try and build a larger story by including activism and work that's been photographed over years. So it creates, you know, we're in a time of instant gratification and looking for sensationalism, and we're working to move away from sensationalism and into revealing, like you said, the deeper human consciousness and ways we can move beyond current patterns of
people. I always felt that photographs, whether it's a family photograph or something that appears in Life magazine, remember the big Life magazines, that they were great at hiding something because you only saw what was an instant. You never saw what took place before that picture or after that picture. Are they just smiling just simply because there's a camera in front of them, or crying because there's a camera in front of them? So it does allow us to understand that moment in time. But after college, after you studied, was it journalism, correct?
Yes.
Your father was very, very conservative and believed in education. Your mother was a gypsy, and you moved multiple times, 30 times. So that probably is a part of who you are, and that's why you got into taking pictures when your mother gave you a point-and-shoot camera at a very young age, because you wanted to remember where you are today, because tomorrow you may be in a different spot. But after graduating from college, you started touring the world, and that's what took on a very visceral effect and really opened up your mind to a greater degree that you probably never even imagined.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that I was fortunate to be exposed to so many different
we
types of things.
We want you
things.
On camera here so the world can see you. There you go.
All right.
Slide over to your right. Is that correct? All right. Good. All producer right. says we're good.
Okay. Great.
And bring that microphone right up to you. Sorry about the interruption.
I didn't even know we were going to do film today.
Oh, we do everything. It's multimedia.
Yay. The world should be explored.
We're actually on the way to the moon right now as well.
I mean, that's the
Why
thing about
time?
Life is that we should treat it as precious and sacred. And whether we're dealing with art or human trafficking, the purpose of life is that it's sacred and precious. So no matter what I'm working on, I'm photographing that which I believe in. And I think we need to move towards solutions and the awe-inspiring. And I've exposed a lot of darkness, but I haven't shared it yet because I was waiting until I had a body of light work to complement it.
Well, that's your whole metaphor or meaning, I should say, and I don't want to put words in your mouth by any mean, Layla. By the way, I'd love to have a friend named Layla. I've never known a Layla, so just
well,
having a friend.
Come to the show, be involved.
Oh, yeah.
We want everyone in
we
the
will,
community
we will,
to
but
be
just
involved.
Even meeting
That's
you.
The important thing
I know
here
a Layla.
Is that there's a lot of people in this world, and it's only together
Absolutely.
That we're going to make a solution.
So go back to your point about light. There's so many different dark things in this world. Actually, even from politics, listening to our previous guest, John Lawrence, about how dark politics can be in the infighting and feel like we're hitting our heads against the wall. But within the dark, you have to expose the dark to get light.
Yeah, and we've been exposing the dark for mm-hmm. many years as a community. And so now I think we have to really step up and move into quantifiable solutions and the fact that human beings are capable of more and we can do better. And we don't need to be living these atrocities.
Layla Love, what was it? Was it one particular time, something that you saw in your life that was completely unthinkable, unfathomable, made your stomach turn, that you said to yourself, wow, yeah, this is what I'm meant to do. Not just take pictures, but to take pictures of despair, travesties, you name it.
I've always taken pictures of both simultaneously. I think they exist in the world simultaneously. However, there was a time when I was 21, I went to West Africa, and I went to Cameroon, Nigeria, Chad. I was on the border of Darfur and Chad, and we had been photographing. It was my first, like, paid journalism job. I was super excited. Yay. It was amazing. I had wanted to do this, but I didn't realize how... I did realize how dangerous where I was going, and I went anyway, despite a lot of people telling me not to. And but what I didn't expect to see was how young these girls were, and how sweet and how innocent and how full of life and heart, and how that's what was being preyed upon. And the human trafficking, you know, to me is similar to, like, the hunting of a deer. It's like the joy that people get from destroying something that's beautiful and precious. And so
pure.
That's what we're working against, is, like, it doesn't serve the men who are destroying these women, because simultaneously they're destroying themselves, they're destroying their family, and the fabric of society is disintegrating rapidly with the onset of this epidemic of human trafficking. It's the third largest, rivaling for the second largest black market trade in the world, and it's human beings.
Is it a number like 40 million?
45.7 million was the UN estimate in 2016.
Wow. Unbelievable. But you're doing something about it. You're bringing that darkness to light.
Yeah, we're working hard as a team. I am working with a group of incredible people to create this nonprofit, The Rise of the Butterfly. I'm here with my lead producer of the show, Milo, and there's a huge group of people that we've been working with in different cities and different states, and it's just beginning to see how we can bridge this fine art world and this awe-inspiring beauty and bring people in and make them aware
Absolutely.
That they can live better.
And we're going to hear from Milo in just a few minutes, but I want to talk to you about your youth, because you had a very non-traditional upbringing, mostly due to your health. And of course, with your family structure, and everyone has, you know, stories about their family dark past. But yours kind of took a toll on your health. You were in a wheelchair for 7 years. You were diagnosed with a condition that was similar to Parkinson's, correct?
Yeah, dopa-responsive dystonia.
Dystonia, correct.
Very close to Parkinson's.
And so this came out of nowhere?
Well, I was 5 years old, and it... it's a hereditary condition, so my mother is the carrier of it. But it's rare that it shows up so early, and, you know, probably from a lot of stress and pressure that I was under, but also genetically, you know, one can be predisposed. But what I've learned through the process, I'm in process of transforming myself and my health. And
aren't we all?
I think the amazing part is when you move into freedom, which is everything that I'm about, is like you're moving away from pharmaceuticals, you're moving back into nature, you're learning about epigenetics, you're learning about how to heal yourself. You know, I was working with John Gray, who is the guy who wrote Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. He has Parkinson's. He showed me this whole incredible protocol with minerals and amino acids, and I've been around, you know, I've been healing in natural retreats in Kauai off the grid for 7 months. I think we're all capable of so many ways of participating with life more.
Talk to me about, if you can remember, at age five, what kind of kid were you? Happy, mellow?
Yeah, I was super happy.
A thinker, yeah? Mm-hmm. Are you happy now?
Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Do these times where you travel to different parts of the world and see the sex trafficking, disease, death, horrible, deplorable conditions, does that fuel you to keep doing what you do?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't think that ignorance is bliss. I think that ignorance and living a mediocre life by will is a terrible tragedy that many of our beautiful citizens are facing. They don't know how to engage and participate. And so I think happiness is found through service and through creation.
True.
And I do both all the time.
I love that. Happiness is found through service. Do you think the adverse times that you experience from 5 until 12 with all your health challenges made you certainly more resilient, obviously, but gave you, in addition to your mother's camera that she gave you, a different perspective and kind of catapulted you into adulthood faster than the normal child? And do you think that has given you a deeper sense of finding out more about consciousness?
I think being confined and not having, you know, when I was
in a chair,
4 years
about.
Old, I was in ballet and gymnastics 5 days a week. I wanted to really be physical in my body. And I think now, once I'm finishing this tour and I've been engaging in stem cell therapy and all sorts of interesting things that have healed my vision and my body again. And so I'm a strong advocate to keep getting healthier, to keep participating more, to keep making more art. So, you know, to really, I think being frozen gets you deeper into your imagination, you know. And so I spent a lot of time in my internal world and traveling a lot. I learned that everybody was hurting and everybody was thriving in some ways, and that we both had both inside of us. You know, I saw rich billionaire people in palace-type situations who had everything, but they're still hurting. And I saw people who had way worse lives than me who were still thriving. So, you know, you really have to look at the human soul and our ability to keep going.
Absolutely. And your ability to say, well, you're frozen in your body because you're in a wheelchair and you're able to be very introspective, but also in your wheelchair, and also talk about your vision loss, because it's uncanny that you had loss of vision and here you are, one of the leading photographers worldwide. So this must mean the world to you that you have this gift of sight.
Absolutely, for sure. I mean, it was a very scary moment, you know, of time to really be without vision and to know the depth of how precious that is and how vulnerable we are when our senses are lost, but then again, how we can strengthen other things to compensate. So I'm always an advocate about going with your strongest angle and reverse engineering if you need to fix a situation, you know. So I just
tell me
like
about
a cat with nine lives.
Bring it on. Tell me about your experience in Australia. You were attacked, and it's one of the things that you I think that makes you very raw and unique, that a lot of people would be obviously very focused on recuperating, convalescing, etc. But you turn a camera around and you became the subject yourself. You wanted to document the actual abuse that took place.
Yeah, absolutely.
Did that just come naturally to you?
Yeah. It was the first thing I did when I became conscious, because I felt like here's a story that I can cover where I can, and I'm putting those pictures on the wall of the gallery for the
Great.
First time.
Which we're getting to momentarily.
But I mean, the whole point of the story is how vulnerable that is. But not to hold shame, not to hold any sort of victimhood, but just to say, I'm not going to plant this disease with inside myself.
Sure.
This is this man's poison. This is his disease, and he needs to heal from that. And I wish him well on his journey. And I'm going to make art, because I can't photograph any other subjects as vulnerably as myself. I have permission to photograph myself, but I would never photograph another person that way.
Unless
it's unethical.
Not even with consent?
No. Because it's, unless they came to me and asked.
Of course.
Then I would.
Yes, of course. Talk about being imprisoned and why and where. Choose one of the above.
I was in West Africa and we had been, you know, photographing this thing, and we were this thing being like women that had blinded themselves and self-mutilated themselves in order to not be taken into human slavery.
Would that be genitalia as well?
We were focused on photographing the situation with the eyes, which
yes,
is a
way
less known story.
Yes, but I didn't mean photographing genitalia, but I mean they would do that as well, not to
well,
be taken.
Well, it's two separate things, but
okay.
Yes. I mean, the genital mutilation is a whole different atrocity, but it's part of the same story, which is that women are not autonomous. We're not in control of our own body. We don't feel safe to walk the streets, you know, and now we're abducting children. And so for me, the issue is really that life can't be bought or sold. So when I was in prison, you know, I really had to go into a deep meditative state and in order to survive.
And why were you imprisoned?
Because we had resources and we're in one of the most dangerous parts of the world and I have a camera. And,
I figured
know,
I just wanted to hear you say
this.
It's a
real basic thing, you know. I'm in one of the four most dangerous countries in the world
at
the
time. Were you formally charged or were you just put into prison?
There was some paperwork and stuff that happened. I didn't speak the language.
Sure.
So.
How long were you imprisoned for there?
It was like 4 days, but it felt like 4 years.
Sure, sure. And where else were you? Had you served time for doing similar things?
Oh, my goodness. This is a lot of questions.
A lot. This is an interview. This is a give and take.
Right.
People want to know about you, Layla Love.
Yeah. Well, there's... I've been through, you know, I've been through a lot of traveling situations with stories. I was working in India and Calcutta. There was some really beautiful work there in different orphanage situations and with these children and that are being lost. I was like super encouraged by watching Born into Brothels. And that was fascinating work. I went with CNN student reporting, this guy Charles Tess, to Japan and did work with women in the glass ceiling and how these are the most educated women in the world and they have to be exported because there's not enough. Anyway, so I've done that story and I went into Vietnam and I was working with the war atrocities in a museum program for children that were blind as well. You know, so I focused on the blind stuff, the human trafficking stuff in different places and within the United States, you know.
Well, it's also kind of a double entendre.
The United States.
Sorry for cutting you off there, Layla. It's sort of a double entendre also when you say blind, too, because it's almost like information that's not available. So you're making this available about people, obviously, with visual impairments and or blindness.
Mm-hmm.
So that, too, is, you know, very, very advantageous to get this critical information outside. Now, you've also been in very dark places. You've also been in very posh places, royal families, things of that caliber. So you're probably not much on pomp and circumstance, knowing you for the last 25 minutes. But it's good to know that people understand your mission and hopefully embrace your mission and support your mission.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think we just need to bridge these worlds. I've seen beautiful people in dire situations and beautiful people in very privileged situations. And how do we bridge those? You know, half of us are dying from a lack of means while the other half is dying from a lack of meaning. And there's a win-win situation we can create here. I think
Look at Puerto Rico.
With this extreme wealth have such a beautiful opportunity right now to come and pour their wealth into change they can see in their lifetime, you know. And that is evolution, and that's why we're all here.
Well, there is change you can see in your lifetime, and it's happening next week. It's a show called Rise. And Milo Pirlo is the lead show producer. Milo, welcome to the show.
Hi, Mark. Nice to meet
you. Hope you didn't fall asleep over there.
Oh, it's totally fine.
I have a line of questions for you as well. Hope you're not going to get mad at me.
I'm ready for it, actually. So I just want to correct. It's Milo Pirwola.
Pirwola.
Okay. Totally fine.
We're going to go with Milo for now. Milo, how long have you guys known each other?
I met Layla about 2 years ago. I was heading off into Costa Rica in order to work with a project there. It's a self-sustainable retreat that's designed for progressive thinking, and it employs the local culture and it integrates the local culture. So it was something right up my alley. And when I met Layla, she was actually coming to New York, so we kind of exchanged. And we just had a little bit of time to spend together, but it was she's doing exactly the same thing that I'm doing, so we just missed the opportunity to work together then. And then she called me up and she spoke about this show, which is a fundraiser. And what really attracted me to this show was that we're taking fine art, which is something that's usually considered a luxury, and fine art sells for significant amounts of money, and that has become a resource for programs that confront human trafficking around the world through the foundation Rise of the Butterfly, which is Layla's nonprofit organization. And so for us to take this spectrum of wealth where we have the one end, which is the 1%, and we've got the other end, which is most of the people in the world, and to take the funds from the fine art world with the wealthy and connect them to the other end, we're effectively creating a cycle of funding that helps us promote these programs that really have an opportunity to change people's lives and the entire world for the better. And just one thing I want to kind of piggyback on is your previous guest talked about how in these stressful and bipartisan times, a lot more people are becoming involved in humanitarian work and activism. And so I think that this is the perfect opportune moment to bring to light an issue that it is not a bipartisan issue. Both sides of the aisle agree that human trafficking is an atrocity. And so there's no resistance that we have. Right now, we have to create an opportunity for people to come forward
and
to help us out.
It happens right here in the tri-state area.
That one of the worst places in the world is the Port Authority. Yeah. And we're staying in Hell's Kitchen right now. We're right next to it. It's probably 500 feet away from us.
There was someone actually who's just sentenced within the last 2 weeks. There's a truck driver who had all those human traffic victims that died in the back of the trailer due to extreme hot conditions in the last 2 years.
Yeah. And, you know, another thing that I want to talk about is it's not easy to be in this position. Layla has spent her entire life building herself up as an artist, as someone who has influence. She spent time with some of the world's greatest artists, as with her mentoring her with Gloria Steinem, who was a personal mentor to her. She has exhibited at APAD, Paris Photo, Art Basel, Miami. So it's not like Layla's someone who found herself on the stage and now has a voice. It's that she has been building this voice her entire life with the intention of helping people. So it's a lifelong journey, and this is just this show is just the beginning of a worldwide
segment,
show. Exactly.
And I want to read a piece from Gloria Steinem. Quote, "Layla Love is an artist in all the best senses of that word, in love with and filled with the energy of life, from suffering through miracles. Her work is universal and unique at the same time. You will always know it's hers and your own," end quote, Gloria Steinem. And she's your partner on this particular exhibit, Rise, correct?
Well, she has mentored me a lot along the way and created space for me to rise. And I was over in her house one time after traveling and several experiences together that were pushing me in a new direction. And so one time I came over and with just a plan of like, what should I do with my art and my life and how do we bring this forward? And that idea was conceived at that time. She was putting one of my pieces, Soulmates, up that became in her house. It became the poster picture for this nonprofit. And so it was the idea of transformation being possible. And she said, well, you know, you can use my quotes and your art and we can do
something.
Is that
this or is this the invitation?
This is the invitation.
But it's a great invitation.
Yeah, this is a tiger. I like photographing animals.
Why wouldn't you? So let's talk about Rise. It's happening Thursday, May 17th, starting at 6:30, and it's running through June 15th, correct?
That's correct.
Opening night is Thursday, May 17th. You have 10,000 square feet.
Oh, 5,000 square feet. It's 5, a ground 000. Floor space in Chelsea, right next to...
I like to make things sound bigger.
Right on. It's on 25th Street between 10th and 11th. And,
how can people get tickets for this?
It's just big enough. It's real enough, and it's free, and it's available.
So
it's
so the best way to do it is to RSVP. You can go to riseofthebutterfly.com. It's under events.
Riseofthebutterfly.com.
And if you want to RSVP, it's Layla Love Art at peoplesrevolution.com. We're working with Kelly Catrone, who is a leader in women's activism right now, also had her own MTV show, which touched a lot of people. And so she's someone who can really has the capacity to amplify this. And one thing that I really want to say is that when we came into this, we were looking at having a gallery, pretty standard, open and closed and everything. But the overwhelming support that we have received from our sponsors has given us this opportunity. So we have M3 is Biodynamics. It's a progressive company out in California that's working with herbs and oils in order to discover untapped potential for the different things that are disappearing in the jungle. So there's a lot of things that are being touched upon here.
Absolutely, sure.
But we also have Vibe App. We're working with...
Vibe App has just released an app program just right now that this week coming up with a show for my publication, The She of God. I have a book being published through Waterside Productions that will be at this show, and there's an app that goes with it. And proceeds from all these things, all these projects, are all funneling to support the human trafficking.
And is your art for sale at this actual event, Rise?
Well, so I'm going to just run through the other sponsors. We have to be thankful for this. We have Creative Visions, which is a hub for nonprofits. That's the reason that we're in the process of actually obtaining nonprofit status. So nonprofit is we're able to collect funds and provide the tax benefit as a result of Creative Visions. We have Moondog, which produced the video that you guys saw. Anthony Hayden Guest, who is the curator of the gallery and an internationally acclaimed art critic. Free the Slaves Foundation, Sands of Silence, World Dignity Forum, and the Hidden Tears Project.
Voices for Freedom, I love. And you know Patty.
Yes, Patty's amazing. I had to thank Patty for bringing us together, by the way. Yeah. And also, who's speaking the night of the opening?
So we're going to have several notable individuals speak. We have the Free the Slaves Foundation is coming up from from Washington, D.C. We have people flying over from California. Patty Channer is going to be one of the people that speaks. Mm-hmm. We have Jim Justice, who created he just received an award from the Bill Gates Foundation for creating a condom in Africa for women. So there's a lot that's coming together. But what I had mentioned before is, again, we're so excited that this has grown so much, but we are desperately in a position where we are still looking to amplify how many people receive the information about this show. Because the month that we are in this space, we called every single humanitarian organization that deals with human trafficking, and we said to them, we're in New York, we're in Chelsea, we've got New York Times, we've got Vanity Fair, we've got Page Six writing articles, please come and talk about this. Mm-hmm. We're using this to amplify the collective voices of all these organizations. So it's not just us doing this. Everybody's doing this. The fact that you brought us onto the show is showing us that in this dire time of political bipartisanship, we are all able to come together as artists, and this is the time for us to be able to make the most impact, because people are listening. They're not pacified by comfort, but they're understanding that there is an irritation in society today, and so they're receptive to change. So as difficult as it may feel right now, this is the time that's going to be written about in the history books, and we have the opportunity to participate.
Well said. Layla Love, obviously this is a major goal in your life, and this is just one little spinnacle or splinter going toward achieving this. What is the next step in terms of ending, eradicating sex trafficking and more?
We will be doing
We have about 30 seconds, by the way.
A series of shows around the world and across the country. We're calling on more butterfly ambassadors to reach out and become part of our mission. There's many ways for us to get involved. This is something where we become stronger together, and just looking at yourself is the first thing you can do, because there's always we can do better.
And fantastic. And Milo, give me that show information again for tickets.
It's riseofthebutterfly.com. Just go to events and you're also going to be able to browse Layla's art and learn about the entire organization.
And that's happening the opening night, Thursday, May 17th. The show is actually running through June 15th, 555 West 25th Street. That's 555 West 25th Street. And all that information is on riseofthebutterfly.com. My name is Mark Farrell. Layla Love, it was such an immense pleasure meeting you. I cannot believe I've had the opportunity to meet someone with such a gifted eye, an immense heart, and someone with an appetite to do such great in this world.
Absolutely. You know, we're going to make it fun and exciting along the way, because there's a lot of work to be done. But we have ballet dancers and art on gold, and we bring it all together, and together we change.
Keep being a gypsy. Never lose that gypsiness. Milo, thank you so much. You're coming back in the future, because we have a lot to talk about. Ex-lawyer, entrepreneur, what else?
A human being.
Human being. That's it. Human being. But you got a lot more. Special thanks to our author, John Lawrence, and to Mark Farrell, and for you for listening. If you'd like me to speak at your school, college, or corporation, check out markfarrellmotivation.com for talks on overcoming adversity, drugs and alcohol, self-entitlement, celebrating differences, and more. Have a great day. This is the Progressive Radio Network. Gary Knowles next.